So first of all, thank you everybody for coming on a rainy day. I know coming out to events on a rainy day is harder than coming out on a sunny day. But thank you also to the student support for migrant workers. I think organizations like these are the backbone of our building of the struggle, and I think it's really important that there is such an organization in Guelph doing this type of work. So before I start this presentation, I first wanted to acknowledge that we are meeting here today on Indigenous land, occupied Indigenous land. And as no one is illegal, we believe it's important to recognize that the struggle for migrant rights cannot take place without a fight in solidarity with Indigenous people here on Turtle Island for their right to sovereignty. In South Central Los Angeles, about 3 years ago now, in 2006, there was a photo that was taken of a demonstration that took place in South Central LA in which a young child was holding a sign that said, "We didn't cross the borders crossed us." And a simple phrase, but it became sort of a rallying cry at so many demonstrations that took place that year, demonstrations that have taken place subsequently here in Canada, in Ontario, in Quebec. And the meaning behind that is very essential, is that what we're talking about, what we are working towards as No One Is Illegal and as a movement for migrant justice, isn't just a struggle about immigration. This is a struggle about a broader economic and political context, that the Canadian immigration policy is intricately linked to our ability to exploit workers, right? Our ability to exploit immigrant labor, and it's been historically rooted in Chinese laborers who worked and died building a railroad for European expansion into Indigenous lands in the West. And it continues to this day, whether it's a migrant worker program for Filipino living caregivers or migrants working in the farms, Mexican and Jamaicans, or if it's people working in the back of hotels, if it's people working in the taxis, if it's people working in construction sites, if people working as janitorial services. There are so many people who are living and working here today in Canada without full immigration status, right? Do people know? I'm wondering. People throw out numbers. What's your estimate? How many people live in Canada without documentation? Throw out a number. Come on.
Probably more than the Canadians.
Possibly. But throw a number out. I'm just interested. What would people think?
2 million.
2 million? 5 million? It's hard to guess, right? Why? Because it's an invisible population, right? Academic estimates, looking at, you know, deportation rates of people coming in and never going out, all this stuff, have put the number at a minimum of 200,000, but a ceiling way above that with no way of knowing how many people have actually come here, right? And the other thing we have to understand about the term illegal, right, is that it's a government-placed term to essentially criminalize people, to make them seem like they're bad people, bad guys, bad girls, for breaking some invariable law by crossing a border, right? And again, we didn't cross that border, right? The borders were put on them. And borders take place in a number of different ways. Borders aren't just when you go to Buffalo or you go to Detroit. Borders take place for people who are undocumented, right? When you go to, for instance, the food bank and the person says, "Oh, we just need to get your driver's license or some identification so that we can get you food." Or you go to a community health clinic because your child is sick and they say, "Well, actually, we need an OHIP card or we need something for you to be able to get a prescription for your baby who's sick," right? The reality is that borders take place, and borders are, in this globalized world, more than just, you know, the scary United States immigration guard who's like, you know, "Are you bringing anything in from the United States? You know, are you bringing people in from the United States?" So on and so forth, right? The reality is that every day, particularly people without documentation experience borders, And the other thing we have to understand is that immigration status is not a static, and we have this thing, it's a funny thing, we call it permanent residence. Yet, in the last few years, permanent residence has been revoked time and time again by the Minister of Immigration, right? And so, what you end up seeing is rather than, you know, these are the people who are legal and these are the people who are illegal, what you end up seeing is somebody's immigration status flows from the line of legality and illegality, depending on a situation, depending on your refugee status, depending on your immigration status. And so this is sort of the context in which we're struggling right now. This is sort of the environment in which we're building this big, broad movement, right? And what No One Is Illegal is actually a group that just encompasses little pockets of all of that, right? There are students, there are migrants, there are people who don't have documentation, there are people with documentation, there are trade unionists, there are church members, there are social service agencies. And the idea, at least in Toronto and in Montreal and Vancouver and Halifax and Ottawa and other places where No One Illegal groups have sprung up, is that we want to develop a broad-based movement that doesn't just say there are loopholes in the system and we need to fix them, but says that the immigration system is rotten to the core and we need to change it. We need to completely change what is going on, because essentially, right, we're not living through an economic crisis or a decline or a downturn like the media says. What I think, what we believe we're living through is the results of this economic system, the results of economic capitalism, the results of this disaster system that's been put in place. And this is intentional. It's intentional that farm workers are brought here to be exploited and then thrown back, right? It's intentional that they don't have jobs in their home countries for them to work in, right? Because agreements like NAFTA take away those jobs, take away rights to land, take away rights to farming, and push people into the cities to compete for what little jobs there is, and then push those people from cities across a dangerous United States border in which your chances of living are not very high, just to make pittance or like slave labor salaries in the United States or in Canada, right, for the amount of time you can before you're either put in jail, get sick, get hospitalized, and are sent back home. And that's a reality of what's going on. So I think to contextualize sort of what happened on April 2nd, I think we have to sort of understand sort of what's been happening, at least over the last 5 years. There has been a radical shift in immigration policy in Canada over the last 5 years, particularly, not just under conservatives, but particularly under conservative government of Stephen Harper. Before him, the Liberal Party was heading towards that direction, so I don't want to give them any props, right? But I do want to note that in January 2006, we did in the end of 2006, we did a Freedom of Information Act request to look at deportation rates and to look at detentions of migrants following the Conservative election. And what we saw was essentially, you had kind of like the Liberal rate, which was really high, and then you saw it sort of mounting to a real serious crisis in about March and April of 2006. And this is when we first started seeing what people are calling U.S. immigration tactics, but what have generally been seen in Europe, Australia, and other places as well, which is essentially immigration enforcement being very aggressive in how they attempt to apprehend people. So what we started seeing in downtown Toronto was immigration enforcement officers going to, for instance, the local shopping mall and listening for people speaking in Spanish or Portuguese or any other language and saying, hey, I want to see your ID, and trying to get people's identification and actually pulling people out of the shopping malls, pulling people out of subways, pulling people walking down the street, which is completely against the law, but the government completely ignored their own law because, again, the population that they're apprehending really has no right to fight back under their own system. So We started to get calls, as no one is illegal, in about March of 2006 from social service providers where people's family members were in panic because their husband or wife or sister or friend was picked up at the Dufferin Mall or picked up at outside Lansdowne subway station. And what we saw was incredible. There were, in a matter of 1 or 2 days, about 600 people who assembled onto the sites of where those people were picked up and held protests and vigils and refused to leave and gave out information. And we shut down the Dufferin Mall. And there was no shopping for 2 hours in the city of Toronto, which I guess is a big thing for the Dufferin Mall, because the Dufferin Mall folks decided that they don't want immigration enforcement to come into their mall anymore because it was bad for business. And then what we did see right following that was in April of 2006, and I'm sure people have heard about that, where immigration authorities then decided their next great stronghold would be to go into high schools and pick up students, and then say, phone the parents and say, hey, we got your kids here. You can come pick them up and come to jail with them, or we can deport them without you. So it was used as a dangling tactic, and the students that we first got word of that this happened to was a family from Costa Rica called the Lizano Sosas. And Kimberly and Gerald were 14 and 15 going to high school at Dante Alighieri, and they actually had just come from a session in which it was a whole school retreat in which they learned about the United Nations Rights of the Child Treaty, in which the rights of a child to education is enshrined anywhere regardless of your status. This is what they learned that weekend. The next Monday they go to school, and immigration enforcement comes into the school, and the principal on the announcement essentially calls them into the office, and they're brought out like with handcuffs into an immigration van and whisked off to immigration prison. And what's interesting about Kimberly and Gerald is that in their struggle to get out of detention and to try and fight their own deportation, they came out from that one presentation and they said, no, no, we learned that this is a right, and we don't want to be deported, but we don't want this to happen to anybody else. And they began this groundswell of a campaign, an incredible campaign in which students and teachers and parents and community members and trade laborers and all these people started to go every week to the Toronto District School Board meetings demanding a don't ask, don't tell policy in which the immigration status would not be disclosed and that nobody would be asked immigration to be able to enter schools. Also demanding that immigration enforcement officers be completely barred from entering into Toronto schools. And what's interesting about that is, again, the government broke its own law. The Ontario Education Act clearly states that regardless of your immigration status, everybody has the right to school. The actual Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which is very evil, right, even stipulates that that students are allowed the right to education regardless of their status. So by violating that right, the government created a huge groundswell. And what we saw was that we were all there, and I remember this vividly. There was all these, what are they called, trustees, school board trustees sitting there, and there was one or two that was supportive, and everyone else was like, I don't know. But like as the deputation started to happen, and as sort of the discussion started to happen, all of a sudden, you saw the vote come, and one by one, they all stood up, because none of them could justify violating people's right to education. And so what we saw was the passing of the first in Canada of a don't ask, don't tell policy in the school system, and one that has continued to be passed, and people continue to fight for it, because everybody here, I'm sure, knows that when governments pass laws, sometimes they forget to actually implement them, follow them. And so our sort of the next phase of what we've been doing is to consistently remind them that this is your policy now and that this is part of our movement. And our movement's not going to stop at this school or that school. We want to make sure that school boards here, school boards in Kitchener, school boards in London, and throughout Ontario and Canada, are following that same policy and that that's building, right? That's what happened in 2006. In 2008, we saw an elevation of those raids. What we saw was a plant in Mississauga was essentially rounded up, encircled by police, Mississauga police, Peel police, and immigration enforcement, so that nobody could leave any of the doors. The doors were locked shut. Immigration enforcement went in, and basically they did this. Check every single person's ID. You on one side of the room, you on the other side. You on one side, you on the other side. Those who had identification were valid identification were allowed to go back to their work. Those who weren't were rounded up, en masse, sent to a detention center, not really told their rights, not told what was going on. Majority of them were actually living caregivers who had been working a second job, moonlighting a second job, on top of the 12, 13 hours they do already, because they couldn't afford to, they needed the extra money to send back to their family because what their employer was paying them wasn't enough to support their family. And because that they were working the second job, moonlighting, for instance, that they were said to be in violation of their living caregiver agreement, and so they were sent back to the Philippines. And so we saw this as a new step, a new U.S.-style tactic, something that we had seen in the United States for about 10 years, but had never happened in Canada, which was a mass raid on a particular plant. And I'm sure Janet could talk a lot about the fact that small-scale raids take place almost every week against migrant farm workers throughout the province, and those are just as heinous of a violation of people's rights. But to see these large-scale raids really set signal to migrant communities that they were going to be under attack at an unforeseen level. And we mobilized again, and in 2007 and 2008, demonstrations around May Day have grown significantly. And the networks have grown stronger, and groups like Migrante and Justicia and No One Is Illegal and hundreds of other groups have become more coordinated, more able to work together, and have become stronger as organizations because we've had to react to this changing environment. In 2009 and April 2nd, we saw the next phase of escalation, which was multiple raids on the same day in various cities. And what we saw was raids in a community called Bradford, which is a sort of borders York and Simcoe regions, near Lake Simcoe, and a community called Markham, which I'm sure most people know, just north of Toronto. And again, a similar thing happening where police, regional police, working with immigration enforcement. How much of each regional municipal police budgets are designated for immigration enforcement?
7%.
Zero. 0%. Immigration enforcement is federal legislation. It is not criminal legislation. And police have no authority, no jurisdiction, no reason to be doing immigration enforcement, other than it's sort of a helpful thing for them to do for, you know, their friends, their brothers, their sisters in immigration enforcement. Which is a very interesting thing because, again, by having the police work with immigration enforcement, it continues to place on people the label that they are criminal for what they are doing. That there's a criminalization aspect, right? That these are dangerous people. The people who were arrested in this round of raids were almost entirely, about 60% from Thailand. Thai workers who had essentially slipped through the immigration system in terms of either they were in temporary work programs or they were guaranteed a job that went south and so on and so forth. Various ways in which people are lured here and there's no opportunities for them once they get here. Working here, attempting to take money back. They were sent to a detention center called the Heritage Inn in Toronto, which holds roughly about, I guess, probably comfortably maybe 100 people. Generally, there's about 200 people, and that includes complete families with babies, children, mother. And, you know, they call it the Heritage Inn. It's supposed to look like a hotel, so on and so forth. But it's a prison with bars and cells and cages, and there's 23-hour lockdown for parents and for children, regardless of your age. You know, there's one-size diaper for, and anybody who's a parent knows that one-size diapers don't fit all, right? And that creates problems. And there's really desperate conditions in there. Well, they added to that already full thing every single person who was picked up in that raid, which is roughly about 100 people, into that detention center. Well, guess what? They didn't have enough lawyers to deal with the cases. They didn't have enough federal prosecutors to deal with the cases. So what they decided to do instead, and this is likely pre-planned, but what they decided to do was essentially explain to the workers that if they signed a paper, things would work out really better for them. And that paper was essentially a forfeiture of their right to anything, and it was basically accepting a deportation. And without a lawyer being present and so on and so forth. And what was it, last week, 41 of them or 42 of them were sent home without any sort of ability, right? And so No One Is Illegal, Migrante, Justicia, other organizations have been working with lawyers in the detention center to really start to fight this type of thing. And we are actually organizing for either the end of May or early June, something that will develop into a raids response team for the Toronto area. And that's something that I think here, with student support for migrant workers and other organizations, those are type of things that we're gonna need to start to think about province-wide as, of course, the raids aren't happening in the GTA, they're happening outside, right? They're happening in places that are you know, outside of Toronto. And so, as such, we're gonna need to really start to mobilize momentum. There is a huge rhetoric from the Government of Canada about temporary and precarious workers being the solution to our economic crisis, at the same time as these same people are being thrown out of work. And the reason for that is, again, the reason why there's been discussion, you know, like the government always talks about, oh, the employment rate goes up, the employment rate goes up. Well, the employment rate doesn't go up. The number of part-time workers skyrockets while the number of full-time good jobs continues to decline, right? So you have a number of, like the exploitation rate, if they measured our economy based on what it is, yes, the exploitation rate has been skyrocketing for the last 20, 30 years. And I think that this recent discourse about we need more temporary worker programs because this is going to be the quick fix to our economy is the exact thing that the government actually wants, right? What it does then is it throws sort of precariously working class Canadian-born workers into competition with temporary foreign workers without rights for the same jobs at lower rates, right? And of course, it really kills the right for unionization, it kills the right for people to organize, and it creates a significant divide between either white or Canadian-born working poor and migrant workers, right? And it's very deliberate on the part of the state. And so in No One Is Illegal struggle, in the movement that we're creating, we understand that these diversions that the state is putting forward, temporary workers, precarious workers, are exactly that. They're diversions from what is really going on, which is that we need to mobilize with workers throughout Canada, both wage and unwaged, because we don't want to get into that rhetoric of saying that, you know, if you're not working a job in which you're getting paid, you're not a worker, because we all know that there are tons of employment that goes completely unrecognized in our economy and is work that builds and develops our communities. However, that we need to mobilize these people together. We need to, you know, reach out to the people being laid off in Oshawa and Windsor and Welland and Guelph and all these other places and say, you know what, this is part of the same thing. This is part of the same system, and we need to unite. And what May 2nd is an expression of that unity. And May 2nd, which is part of our contribution to the International Workers' Day on May 1st, which incidentally, most people talk about, yeah, it was the day of the worker struggle started in Chicago, but it was immigrant workers in Chicago, Slavic immigrant workers, Jewish immigrant workers, Irish immigrant workers, who rose up in Chicago in 1880, who were at the backbone of that struggle. And that's part of that history that gets lost, that immigrant part, that migrant workers have been at the backbone of the labor movement since its onset in North America. It has to be. Migrant workers is all they have, because the European colonists, you know, were occupying indigenous foreign land, right? So I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you so much.